My name is Paul Kaufman, and as the Acting Dean of the Faculty of Business and Economics at the University of Melbourne, it is my pleasure to welcome you to the 71st Annual CPA Australia University of Melbourne Research Lecture. I would like to extend a very special welcome to the CEO of CPA Australia, Mr. Alex Melli, as well as the President of the Victorian Division of CPA Australia, Mr. Mike Wilson, and members of CPA Australia. I would also like to acknowledge the many colleagues, both from the fraternity and from other accounting departments around Australia, and of course, other members of the university that are here tonight. Members of the profession and the general public, I wouldn't want to omit those. Your attendance this evening is testimony to the prestige and long-standing tradition of this lecture series, simultaneously entrenching this tradition for many years to come. It seems entirely appropriate to me that the University of Melbourne, where we pursue our quest for knowledge and innovation embedded in tradition, is host to this cutting-edge research lecture. Tonight's lecture will be given by Professor Miklós Fasahely of Rutgers University, and I am truly delighted that he is able to deliver the research lecture here tonight. This lecture series is the oldest continuous research lecture series at the University of Melbourne. It is endowed by CPA Australia, and the lecture was established for the purpose of promoting and stimulating research and encouraging original contribution to accounting. Before I conclude, I would like to note that this public lecture is being filmed for university purposes, and that any questions you may ask at the conclusion of this lecture will be recorded as well. We are indeed very honoured that Professor Fasahely is here with us today, and I now call on Professor Anne Lillis, Acting Head of the Department of Accounting and Business Information Systems, to introduce him formally.
I'm delighted to have the opportunity to invite Professor Miklós Fasahely to present the 71st Annual Research Lecture. Professor Fasahely is visiting us from Rutgers Business School, where he is KPMG Pete Marwick Professor of Accounting Information Systems and Director of the Rutgers Centre for Accounting Research. He's also a technology consultant for the e-commerce solutions group at AT&T Laboratories. Miklós completed undergraduate degrees in economics at the State University of Guanabara and electrical engineering at the Catholic University of Rio de Janeiro. He gained his MBA at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology before going on to complete his PhD in Management Information Systems at the University of California, Los Angeles in 1973. He's taught accounting and systems topics at the graduate and executive level in the US, Europe, China and South America, where he's also consulted to government and industry on accounting and information technology matters. Miklós' research has been widely published. His work comprises more than 100 articles with publications in leading journals, including the Journal of Accounting Research, Accounting Organisations and Society, Decision Sciences, Auditing, a Journal of Theory and Practice, and the Journal of Accountancy. He's also authored several books on pensions, inflation, e-commerce, programming language, the business applications of microcomputers, advanced auditing, and expert systems. He was the inaugural editor of the American Accounting Association Journal, the Journal of Emerging Technologies in Accounting, and has recently been selected as the incoming editor of the Journal of Information Systems, which is also a AAA journal. His research interests deal with areas such as artificial intelligence in accounting and auditing, internet pricing, the economics of telecommunications, agents in e-commerce, and, as we will hear from his presentation this evening, the area of continuous auditing and control monitoring. By all accounts, the name Miklós Fasahely is synonymous with the field of continuous auditing. He has established this field over a period of 25 years. There's no person more qualified to speak to us tonight on the topic of the coming of age of continuous auditing. His involvement with standard setting and evolutionary issues of the financial world has been far-reaching. He consulted for the FASB in the establishment of Standards 33 and 87, As a member of the CIS Trust Committee, he worked to evaluate the need for auditing standard changes with the emergence of more continuous auditing methodology, and is involved with the development of the XBRL standard. Miklos has travelled extensively throughout his academic career, having just arrived from France yesterday, still on the move, building proficiency in five languages. He's currently a visiting scholar at the Theseus Institute in France. Miklos has taught executive education programs on e-commerce to many large international organisations, including General Electric, Johnson & Johnson, BHP Billiton, Boeing, Baxter, Volvo, Siemens, Chase Bank and AT&T. Miklos' contributions have been recognised by the American Accounting Association. Among numerous awards and honours to his credit, he's a recipient of the Outstanding Service Award and an inductee to their Northeast Hall of Fame. We're honoured to have him here with us tonight. I welcome Professor Miklos Vassahelli to the podium.
Thank you very much. And I would like to thank the University of Melbourne for inviting me to speak here. This is my third visit to Australia, a little bit jet-lagged, but very happy to be here. I have been really involved with continuous auditing for a long period of time, and I kind of welcome this time the opportunity to do a little bit of pondering about what we have learned and where we are going to. The papers I typically present are more technical and work with a whole set of experiments that we have been running in the area of continuous auditing. By the way, can you hear me all the way in the back there? And today I actually had this chance to kind of retrospect a little bit what we learned up to now. And I am going to talk in this tone of trying to think to what we learned and where we are going. And very honestly, we really don't know where you're going. Albert Einstein said that if you know what you're doing, you're not doing research. And so that's what the direction is. I'm going to start by talking a little bit about what we call the real-time economy, and then talk about this issue that we think is kind of paramount of today's world, which is this issue of monitoring control. And then we're going to talk about what we call continuous assurance theory. And we have divided continuous assurance into basically three areas. Two of them, we already have experiments in there and have learned quite a lot about it. The third area is an emerging area that we think that needs to be associated with this thinking of continuous assurance. I use the wording continuous assurance, continuous auditing, pretty much intermittently, one for the other. And the other thing is we have been talking a lot about audit automation in this particular frame. And then I'm going to make some considerations about where the profession and academics should be going. I would like to kind of frame the work we have done is pretty much everything we have done in the continuous audit area has been in association to research partners, large US companies, large worldwide companies. And basically I thank these companies for having participated on this. And sometimes the path of research is a little bit difficult. And I am a participant of the ICPA's Assurance Services Executive Committee. And of course, we spend all our time thinking about new assurance products. But obviously, I'm talking in my own name, not the name of the ICPA or anyone else. Starting with the real-time economy, or there's an article in The Economist, 2002, talking about the real-time economy. They also called it the now economy. And the whole idea behind the now economy or the real-time economy is acceleration of processes. And I use usually the word latency, which basically means delay. And what you perform in business is a set of business processes. And the two major delays, one are the what we call intra-process latency, which is the time that you take to perform a particular process. So if you accelerate your receivables, your general ledger, and et cetera, what you basically are doing is reducing latency. The reason to reduce latency is basically to reduce occupation of capital, meaning the faster you do a particular process, you spend less resources on it. synonymous to reduction of latency these days is the idea of automation. And when you talk about people doing things, you talk about hours and minutes. When you talk about automated processes, you're talking about nanoseconds or milliseconds. So obviously, every time you try to accelerate a process, you impound technology. We call this electronization. In addition to this whole idea of accelerating processes, there is this other step that is a very common step, is passing information from one process to the other. And the lack of compatibility of computer systems or manual systems is notorious and has been a problem always. With the evolution of the W3C, the World Wide Web Consortium standard, XML, was basically derived to make systems talk to each other without having ever met. And we developed in our own profession this idea of XBRL, Extensible Business Reporting Language, where basically you can pass financial statement information from one place to the other very rapidly without manual intervention. Now, in addition to these two things, in intra-process latency and inter-process latency, we also talk about two other latencies, latency of making a decision, latency of implementing this decision. And these are much larger latencies, and these are latencies that are very dependent on the particular conditions that you're talking. We really kind of focus on the first two, where there is tremendous action at this particular moment. I would like to give a little bit of attention to this idea of XBRL. XBRL is basically an interoperability standard. It's a standard that allows two computers to talk to each other and pass financial statements from one to the other. And although XBRL has been progressively being accepted in many different places and became the requirement to many, many different countries, it has been a reasonably slow deployment. It has been nearly 10 years now that they've been working at this particular effect. And one of the points about XBRL is really a representation on electronic form of paper report. So it's not as catastrophic or as a dramatic change on reporting as people say. Actually, the way you prepare XBRL instance, which is a representation of your company's financial statement in XBRL, is basically you pick up the data from your financial statement and put it in electronic form, basically as part of one document. And that's exciting. That actually will accelerate, will grease the flow of information to the financial value chain. But it's not as dramatic as some people think, and it has been slow to evolve. I don't think there is too much of a doubt that XBRL is a worldwide standard and is going to be effective everywhere pretty much over the next 5-6 years. However, XBRL is still very much in the current model of reporting on paper, but now paper is electronic. Now, and that basically focuses us on the report and focuses us pretty much on thinking of auditing a report. And in reality, when you are reviewing, you are attesting to a corporation's, let's say, integrity of reporting, you really should be reviewing the databases of the corporation and linking to the reporting. And the XBRL representation doesn't quite reach that far. Another thing that is very important on the real-time economy and the now economy is the understanding of what monitoring is. And we try to, this is actually out of a KPMG white paper, and we basically talk here about trying to understand the differences between what is continuous monitoring and what is continuous reporting. One caveat here, we talk about continuous, and you imagine nanoseconds after the event, but in reality, continuous is kind of evolving concept very close to the evolution of technology. And some systems have kind of pulses of hours, of minutes. Some systems will have day pulses, even month pulses. So it depends very much on what you're measuring and what you're reporting. The first project that has been recorded on continuous auditing has been this project that we developed at Bell Laboratories from 86 to 91. And in that project, we basically monitored and evaluated very large building system, largest of its kind. And basically, the only way to keep the pulse on that particular system was by some form of continuous assurance. We finished up developing really two platforms, actually one platform with two implementations, and one was really an auditing system. And eventually, the users of the system started complaining that the auditors had much better information than they had. So we finished up developing this thing we called the Prometheus project. That was, we used the same infrastructure, the same reporting schema, but different analytics. One for users and the deliverers of the information, the other one for us as auditors. And this was from 86 to 91, was published in 91, and in good Bell Labs fashion, we delivered it for a post-mortem and went to do the next thing. Turns out that the system, about a couple of months ago, I was going around AT&T to look at something, and I found the system is still working there. Seems that the audit system has been basically left behind, and the operating system has been in place, and the auditors use that particular system. But basically, according to the practice of continuous auditing, continuous monitoring, management is supposed to do continuous monitoring, auditors do continuous audit, and use continuous monitoring in the function. Now, we run a conference, which we call the World Continuous Auditing Symposium, and we will be the 21st of November. And in this conference, we basically used to have basically a group of academics going there and talking about ideas in continuous auditing. Progressively, the Big Four started coming, and recently, software firms that basically picked up some of our ideas and developed products. So the companies that typically in our conference are companies that you will recognize, like ACL, Caseware, et cetera, that have now continuous auditing products and continuous control monitoring products. But the most interesting development in the recent years has been that the actual applications that are being demonstrated are really in internal audit departments. The internal audit departments have basically taken the leadership in developing continuous monitoring, continuous auditing applications, and the names are very much in the names of the companies that we work with, in addition to companies like IBM, Hewlett-Packard, and et cetera, et cetera. And typically also what you see, and this is just a generic observation, you see is that the computer companies that have the technology have implemented this, the barriers to entry is very large, and the banks. Banks and financial companies are very worried about their exposures. We did a comparative study sponsored by KPMG, and in this comparative study, we basically found that the consumer companies, et cetera, are in a much lower level of risk than the banks. And for that reason, this technology is kind of starting much more in the financial area or in the companies that can implement technology reasonably well. Now, I just want to talk a little bit about the conceptualization. What we do today is we assure reports. We get a piece of paper, which is an annual statement, and we look at these reports, and based on the accounting rules that we have today, we develop opinions on this report. I think we're going to tend towards trying to assure processes. And Anne mentioned here SysTrust. SysTrust was an effort by Assurance Services Executive Committee to create a product that the auditor would come in and review what we call system reliability, basically look at how systems work and how effective they are. And basically a system reliability opinion, a SysTrust opinion, an opinion on that you can trust a particular system on operating. And I think we're kind of going away from report assurance towards key process assurance. And eventually, we're also going to have this area that we call data level assurance. And of course, if you look at general ledger or accounts receivable system, and we declare it to be 97% reliable, you would expect that the transaction that it generates is 97% reliable. And unless there is a modifier like transmission that is not reliable, et cetera, the datum that it generates is at that level of reliability. But in this forthcoming world, whereby there is balkanization of data, meaning data comes out of financial statements, separates in pieces, and falls into different analytic engines. We are going to have tremendous need to understand how reliable is the data that you are using to see if you can mix the data on different ways. So this is kind of one trend here. Now, the next trend is I want to talk a little bit about how we conceptualize continuous auditing. The first thing is there are these technologies that facilitate the real-time economy. And the most important technology to really have a real-time economy is what we call sensing or censoring, which is basically capturing transaction in real time. I don't think it's a coincidence that the first recorded application of continuous auditing, and there, it's possible there have been some kind of real continuous monitoring in the military and et cetera, but we don't know about this. But it's because AT&T has been capturing transactions, telephone calls, from mid-70s with the cross-bar systems. And so basically, if you call someone, the beginning of the call, the end of the call, and the time of the call is captured at the moment of the event, just like today in electronic commerce transactions. And because of that, by the time I got to Bell Labs, which was mid-80s from a leave of absence at Columbia, I found that a little bit of data mining, I found these databases working that you didn't find in other companies. So it was kind of an ideal setting that you could try to invent some technology to accomplish certain basically risks felt by AT&T financial management. But we are sensing transactions immediately. At that time, we did have no ERPs. And so basically, they were kind of legacy systems. But the information was there to be used. And Bell Labs was a very advanced technological place, so we could do a lot of things. But we always talk about technologies being implemented. But the other part of it is you really cannot implement technologies well without doing some serious system reevaluation, like reengineering of systems. And one of the things we learned in the AT&T project is basically that systems would have to work a little bit differently to take advantage of these dramatic changes. When the project we did at AT&T, we called the Continuous Audit Project, it was called the CPAS project, and basically looked at data, extracted data, created models to say how the data should be, and when it was different, created alarms. With the emphasis on Sarbanes-Oxley and with our work on Siemens, we started developing this idea of continuous control monitoring. And the big thing about continuous control monitoring is the fact that in old days, a particular control was observable. Basically, if you were controlling a particular activity, you could observe the control. Today, these ERPs have 30, 40,000 controls or 100,000 controls embedded. They are configurable, so basically the users can change it, but they are not observable. So this became a big, big problem for a company like Siemens, which has about 300 SAP facilities, companies that they manage, and they needed to review these companies in some kind of systematic manner and need to understand what was happening with the controls. So we developed this methodology that we call CCM. Today, several of the software firms have software that they sell as CCM software. And most recently, and then of course we changed the name of continuous audit to continuous data audit and continuous control monitoring as the two components. And we added a third component that we call continuous risk management and assessment. And we expect that this is going to be leading to changing audit evidence and changing procedures on auditing and waiting on procedures on auditing. And this is more incipient of the areas. We have one project that we're working on this area. So just give you some examples to kind of show that this is not really just pure theory. We work with a bank. It used to be called Unibanco, and now they merged with Itaú. They are in Brazil, and they are the 15th largest bank in the world today. And Brazil is a very good place to work on continuous auditing projects because the banking system is probably more of computer-wise, IT-wise, more evolved than the American system. So they have large centralized databases, and they have been monitoring their branches for a few years in this project that we have done. And of course, Brazil, because of the surge inflation that they had in the 90s, the occupation of money overnight was very, very expensive. So they really, the clearing in 5 days, clearing in 4 days was not acceptable. So they developed these systems, And they are great candidates, and they felt the need for some type of more frequent assurance. So we did one project, which was 1,400 branches of Unibanco monitoring. And basically, just in a capsule, this project was reviewing 1,400 branches overnight. So the continuous here was one review every night with 18 KPIs, pulling out transactions that were suspect and doing audit reviews for them. And where alarms happened, we would pursue it. And they have did this working for 7 or 8 years until recently to the merger, and we expect it to go now to the 6,000 branches that Itaú Unibanco has. Other interesting thing, just for you to understand the audit, this is actually an article that we're putting together in one of the in one of the practical application journals, is basically that they used to conduct a 160 hours audit every year for each one of the branches. And basically the methodology changed that they now conduct a 40 hours, it's compulsory to 40 hours, surprise audit in every branch. However, it's really driven by the indexes that we develop out of the monitoring. And if particular problems start happening in a branch, there is an immediate audit the next morning, reduced by a factor of 90%. They basically, for every call, for their cost, they think they got 10 times the revenue, the benefits from this particular project. We have also been doing a project in monitoring the transitory accounts, and we have now a project which is basically salesman monitoring and review. And associated with this particular project, we are doing a continuous risk assessment in four of these products and in some of the other activities that they do. So these are basically a data audit type of thing, environment. We've done a lot of these. We are doing more. And we learn a lot of things about operating with banks, which are kind of transportable to other environments. One of the things for the researchers here is that we really typically develop prototypes, analytical prototypes, and then someone has to come in and make it operational. And actually, at Itaú Unibanco, IBM was the system integrator, and they have done substantial amount of the integration. One more comment I want to say there is that this particular monitoring of branches created substantial behavior change among the branch managers or the salespeople. And the moment the word goes out, which is actually a major deterrent for certain filters being in place, behavior changes dramatically. We had a particular episode of reversal of tax payments that occurred about 400 times in 2006. After these filters went into place, basically occurred one time in 2007. So there is substantial type of change. And I already described this. I just want to show you. This is actually a graph of 6 million accounts, 5.5 million accounts that we monitored there over 2008. And basically, the yellow line is the total number of exceptions per week that we picked up, which ranges from 900 to 1,200. Each one of the exceptions was reviewed, and about two-thirds of them were considered okay, and we passed them along. One-third of them were considered suspect, or there were problems with them, and basically an email with the facts of the transaction was mailed to the regional director of that particular area. And we always got responses, and substantially problems were found. The number of errors in this 18 monitored index decreased substantially. On the transitory account effort, basically we did, they have about 12,000 accounts. We evaluated which were transitories. We chose 150 accounts with major risk. We monitored transactions at the mainframe level. And when we found a particular day with a particular account with problems, it's downloaded into a local environment and it's analyzed by extreme filtering. This is the particular system that IBM has been working on implementing it. Now, we did a project with HCA, and HCA is a very large hospital corporation. Actually, it's an old hospital corporation of America, about 200 hospitals, 200 medical units, probably among the largest employers in the United States. And there, what we tried to do is develop predictive models on the supply chain Because the whole idea of monitoring and control is always the same idea. You have an actual, basically measurements out of the database. You have a standard. Compare the two, and if there is a big variation from one to the other, meaning a variance, you create an alarm. Someone has to review the alarm. And in the physical sciences, this is done normally. In accounting, we haven't done very much of that type of thing. And basically, the work at HCA was to develop modeling and the ability to predict transactions. We did a lot of interesting things on HCA, basically in the modeling area. And we managed to model in a much better manner than a traditional budget comparison type of thing. We managed to predict surges. We managed to extract variations on data. And we managed to create some automatic correction on data faults. Interesting project. We're having a lot of difficulty for the academics here with the journals. The journals don't understand the work. And we had the same problem when we did the original Bell Labs work. It took about 3 years to convince the other journal to publish it because they just didn't understand the work. So this is the kind of problem we have. We learned a lot from the HCA project, and we learned that errors can be automatically corrected. We learned that processes are very intricate. And we learned that we need to work substantially more on adaptive modeling. We have done a couple of projects, actually, with MetLife. And it's very interesting for us to think about what we did in a philosophical manner. The MetLife project was basically a forensics project. And you say, forensic, what does that have to do with continuous auditing? Has a lot to do with continuous auditing. Because the idea behind this work and was first on wire transfers, second one was on claims. And the work, basically, you develop a whole set of filters. You test the filters. Auditors go and review the transactions that you think that are more prone to be problems. And once your filters work, the next thing you have to do is architecture. You create the filters, and ex ante, before a transaction is entered, you review the transaction and give it a probability of being fraudulent or being a problem. So forensics are the basic work to develop these analytical models. Now, that said, there is a whole set of implications around it that we think that the American Institute needs to change the rules. And this is actually, we see this on a regular basis. Many of things we do, for example, the auditor traditionally is in a total independent party. He's not on the stream of transactions. Even an internal auditor. Here we really believe that he should be on the track of transactions looking at anomalies. But this has a lot of implications on change. One more conclusion here is we felt that these advanced analytics we use were pretty good. I just want to show you one thing that we did. We use a technology called multidimensional clustering. And the idea is basically you compare in different dimensions data from, in this case, this is one of the client set of data, and transactions that each cluster has its own code. And basically, when you find, first, some clusterings, some small clusterings are all suspect. Other ones are kind of a regular, understandable transaction, and then you start looking at the ones in the extremes as potential anomalies. And we actually found this very, very interesting. We thought this was a very successful effort. We also think that in the future, clustering is going to be a day-to-day tool in pretty much every audit, particularly in general ledger analysis and in certain type of accounts analysis. It was very interesting, some of the clusterings that we found, they were not fraudulent clusterings, they were just anomalous transactions, one after the other. And each one of those transactions was interesting enough to be examined. We have worked actually on three projects, also in the continuous data audit, with Procter & Gamble. And the last one, which is the second one, which is the most interesting, is an audit automation project. We basically broke down the order-to-cash process and automating little pieces of it so the auditor can, on a remote basis, continuously be auditing this particular transaction flow. And this interesting project, by the way, my slides can be available, and we have to figure out a way to pass them out to you. Now, the control monitoring project was a Siemens project. We actually had three projects with Siemens. Now, Siemens is an extremely well-organized company. And They actually have the SAP audits in things that they call audit action sheets, which is basically a listing of procedures that they do. And there are maybe 3,000 procedures. And what we went to them is first created what we call deterministic automation, do extraction of the structure of controls and compare the controls with our baseline. And wherever we found a variation, that was a control exception that we examined. Then we discovered some better models, and that first step was about 25% of the processes could be automated. Then we worked, we basically followed an audit in St. Louis and other subsidiaries, and we found that another maybe 40% of the terms of the types of audit actions could be automated. So the end was that around 63% of the audit action sheet items could be automated. And of course, the other 37 could not be automated, and we have to think carefully about what to do it. And actually, our idea was that we were going to do a re-engineering of what could not be automated to see if this was necessary, because the strength of audit evidence is very strong. Instead of reviewing the SAP system once every 2 years or 18 months that they did, every day they had evidence. So it's a tremendously improvement in the quality of audit evidence. Turns out that they change external auditors, and so we haven't quite done that. What we are doing is a formalization project with them at this particular moment. On the CRMA area, we basically want to, there are all kinds of motivating factors. One is SOX, the other one is the PCAOB that's requiring risk-based audits, and the third one basically is that Basel Accord is changing and doing a lot in the area of risk-dependent things. We basically believe that continuous auditing, like any auditing, is going to have to be risk-sensitive, and the weight of the procedures will have to be sensitive to that. The other thing is risk profiles change very rapidly, and we need to be able to detect changes in risk. Our experimental project at Itaú Unibanco is basically trying to do that, just basically track a series of risk indicators, which we call them KRIs, and measure them. And these are kind of the discussion here of KRIs, and this is pretty much leading edge work, but it's still embryonic. We're just starting this project. Just to conclude, because I'm running out of time here, I would like to just say some of the things in three areas: areas of research, areas of complementary research, and areas of standard. We think that the most important area of research today for academics, and we always talk about research jointly with partners, is basically an idea of formalization of controls. There is no methodology today that can look at a control system and say this should be, if complied with, 90% reliable, 75% reliable. So there is no methodology. So if you go to court in a control case, there is no way to say this is the way this thing should be. Now, that's the design of the system. The next part of it is how well it's being complied, how well it's being obeyed. And that's what continuous control monitoring works for. And we need to be able to have an ideal level of reliability and then some form of saying how well is being obeyed, and that should be the aggregate reliability of the ensuing system. That work doesn't exist and is needed even if it's normative. We need a whole set of standards for business process monitoring and alarming. Actually, the ICPA, the Institute of Internal Auditors, and ISACA all have guidelines on continuous auditing at this moment. Took them a while, but they all have it out there. GTAC 3 on the IAA, ISACA came out with them this year. One area that we think that there is substantial weakening of, I just don't understand why I haven't done it, is confirmations. The manual confirmations make no sense, and even email-based confirmations the AICP is working on is kind of obsolete technology. You need to match database against database to basically stop worrying about population. And we think that there is a lot of little modular audit tools, we call them audit bots, that should be developed, and companies should be able to just put the kit together of these things in the audit automation effort. We talk a lot about the idea of the remote audit, and the remote audit is the auditor constantly in contact with the client, a very strong form of determinant, however, in very different locations. And one more thing we talk about is the idea of auditing for different owners, for different stakeholders. Now, we think that there are some other things that need to be done to work with this. First one is focusing, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley only really talk about financial systems, and really in order to do things right, a la HCA, you need to link the driving process with the financial process. So for example, at AT&T, you need to link the switches that are really switching the telephone calls and counting everything to the financial results, even if there are delays and there are other factors. And in every operation, physical or computer-based with biddable goods, you really need to link what you are doing with what your results. This whole thing of WorldCom had no relationship results to what they were doing is because you don't look at the non-financial areas. So it's very important to expand, and the auditor's role, and that's expanded assurance service, to work non-financial. And despite we having standards in every area, these standards are not, in these three major organizations, these standards are not good enough yet. Okay, and obviously, I argue very strongly for other assurance services besides the traditional audit. And finally, this is kind of more the advocacy thing that we talk the AICPA and with the IIA and et cetera, is that we need to rethink a lot of the rules of auditing and the rules of business measurement, meaning accounting and the way you measure things. Because in this real-time economy, those compromises we did, how much we audit and we obtain this materiality level, all changed. Technology came in, changed the, you can do full population audits, there is no reason to do that. You can control for population doing database to database, and we are not doing this. And is we are not doing that because the standards are slow to evolve. And the International Accounting Standards Committee needs to start, and the International Audit Committee needs to start thinking seriously about breaking some of the sacred cows and changing some of the regulation around independence, around boundaries of systems, around many different things. Also, the way we charge for our services need to kind of go away from the hour base, because hours are not going to be the driving factor. It's going to be automated audits. You're going to invest tremendously to put the audit in place, and the auditor is going to be a monitor. The external auditor is going to be a what we call a maker monitor, a person that monitors activities at a very high level. A couple more comments is we need to put a place on our auditing standards for advanced analytics, meaning we basically do analytical review today at the beginning of the process, basically call our attention to this. And actually, the audit is going to be a continuous thing. The auditing is going to be pretty flat across the year, and the auditor is going to be auditing what we call audit by exception. He's going to be basically reacting when he detects system failures or he detects a large set of anomalies. And in that method, you need to really kind of understand much better the advanced analytics. And just a couple more things. So level of materiality, independence, and the role of analytics needs to be rethought, and some of our sacred cows in auditing standards. I always have to be redefined. I always say that that when you look at the current auditing standards, many required procedures should not be required, should be optional in the audit planning consideration. And just to conclude, we have run these many conferences on continuous auditing in Europe, South America. We run a yearly now financial institution audit, continuous auditing conference in São Paulo. And this website, the Royal Rutgers EDU, Roy is easy to remember, Rutgers Accounting Web, R-A-W, has pretty much slides of everything. I'm going to put these slides in there, and has like slides on 20 or 15 of the conferences and papers and et cetera, et cetera. This is a good place to start if you want to have a look at this particular area. And I strongly recommend that you start thinking about real-time assurance issues. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'd like to thank Miklos for a very stimulating lecture. We have some time for questions. you're going to take a mic still? Thanks. So I'll have a roving mic here if anyone would have a question.
Yes. Just on your second last slide there, you said materiality needs to be redefined. Are you talking about that in terms of exceptions?
Yeah, let me just talk about materiality for a second. Materiality is a concept of relative error. And materiality is first the AICPA, and I don't know the international standard, but BASE never really reached a very good guideline or guidance on what was a material error. There is no real quantitative guidance on that. And the allocation of materiality thresholds within accounts has been pretty arbitrary, and the firms have different guidance there. But the problem is that the concept of materiality was developed in a manual audit environment with the trade-offs between the effort that it takes to audit a particular thing and the benefit you can get from that. And since that concept has kind of formalized in the profession and has been ingrained in the profession, even if the guideline is not very good, the whole information technology has changed, and the cost of performing the assurance or the cost of reviewing transactions has changed dramatically. You can do full sample audits these days. You can do a series of different things you couldn't do there. We have to kind of rethink of what are the trade-offs here between the effort of the audit and the product and how much it costs. Basically coming up with a different balance. I actually am a very strong advocate for a new product of the auditor that most people don't think is a very good idea. But I think that the auditor should have really one product, which is an annual review, or if you do it a little bit more, I would call it the Evergreen Opinion, came out in the AICPA red book that we had, which is basically a website that has your opinion, like a flag or an imprint, and it's evergreen until it gets red, until you find in a continuous mode that things are wrong enough, materially wrong, and change that. So that's one thing. But there is another part of it, which is the audit by exception thing that I think the external auditor should be an independent monitorer or system. And when certain problems are going bad with the company, when you get certain types of alarms, the auditor should be the reliable party that say the company is taking reasonable action on risk changes or on transaction problems or et cetera, et cetera. Maybe this was a long answer, but did I address your question?
Professor, the worst problem I've had in recent times, in living memory, is the world global financial crisis. How did these techniques go in addressing one of the key aspects of the start of that problem with the complex financial derivatives that no one seemed to be aware of? And if it didn't focus on those then, what would be the future prospects?
Yeah, you know, the derivative dilemma is first a problem of lack of transparency. Most of the auditors don't really understand these instruments, just as well as the banks and the managers don't. The second thing is that information, if you look at the way the derivatives were managed within the banks, not even talking about lesser organizations, lesser systems, they were primitive technologies. There is no standardization on these derivatives, and so you really don't have a result that you can accumulate. You could accumulate a general ledger, several different things. Also, the derivatives are treated as contracts. They are contracts. Therefore, a lot of the derivatives, except since recently the FASB kind of acted up a little bit on it and did something, most of them are not really recognized in financial swaps, particularly are basically exchange barter transactions. And until, and this is, comes with what I say regulation needs to change, companies need to have a way to recognize future obligations that are in the contractual nature, not only after they have been realized. And there is nothing essentially wrong about derivatives, and derivatives are actually good ways to effectively allocate capital. There is tremendous difficulty of derivatives that are unmanaged, understood, and poorly documented. And this is actually very common with new technologies. New technologies are put in place, and I'm not talking about only physical technology, but I'm talking about financial technologies. And then society needs to re-engineer itself, reprocess itself to be able to manage those processes. And what we had is a nearly criminal deregulation in Washington, just to talk about America, whereby total laissez-faire kind of personality adopted it. And these very complex instruments were not regulated, organized, and made public enough. Totally out of the scope of what we do with financial statements that recognize traditional transactions reasonably well. I do think that derivatives of many types can be managed, disclosed, and explained to the public in just as way of everything else that we could do, but would need something like a financial derivative XBRL, which standardized them, wouldn't allow haphazard contracting, create standardized contracts, and create cumulative of this type of thing, and match always the hedges. And this can be done. We actually had a little experiment that we did in two different types of derivatives and seemed to work. Now, we don't know all type of derivative. We don't exactly know what else was out there, but I do think the problem is manageable, but society needs to create the mechanisms. People are reasonably negative on new financial reform act, but I think it's a step in the right direction because it creates publicly trading of most of the derivatives and force them to be reasonably standardized, like a future contract. There they are.
Professor, Miriam Kelsall from the Local Auditing and Assurance Standards Board. You've thrown out some very interesting challenges, not only to the profession, but more particularly to the standard setters. How do we get from where we are today to your brave new world?
Yeah, well, honestly, the first thing is we need to get people like you very interested on this. And I never managed to get someone at PCAOB to come to one of our conferences. So, and because they don't see that as a very immediate problem, but I do think that this is a very immediate problem, and if we are not going to be hit by some of the other problems that we are going to be confronting in the future, we need to start thinking them in advance. The second thing is we need to kind of take a kind of zero-base auditing view of the world and say, we assume that that our current processes are adequate. And we cannot assume that. I think the trade-offs, and I wrote up a little paper that's going to be published here in the University of Melbourne, and there I talk a little bit about certain kind of sacred cows in the audit assumption that really cannot be assumed anymore. I don't think you focus on independence, you focus on objectivity. I think that you really need to resolve the automatic confirmation problem, because the moment you resolve the automatic confirmation problem, you get to the next stage whereby you can rely on the size of the population. Now you need to understand what the population is, but you don't have to spend half of your time worrying that transactions were absconded with or transactions were added to it. And this is doable. Today, most companies will have steady partners, maybe 80% of its transactions are with small number of partners, 5-6 partners, and they can do database-to-database confirmation like we do today with CHIPS, with those international money transfer thing with CHIPS and et cetera, et cetera. So this is totally doable. And, you know, I at the AICPA argued strongly that we really should do automatic confirmations. And the idea was we create an email methodology of confirmation, which is totally inadequate. It's just basically manual, doing a little bit more automated something that's manual and deficient. And so we need to kind of open the book of examination of things and try something reasonably different. And I could give examples ad nauseum here of things that I think should be reconsidered. Now, I don't know if I have the solution. I just know that I have seen that the trade-offs have changed dramatically. And you know, my students use the analogy, my PhD students use the analogy of it's very difficult to change the tire of a car when it's in motion. And you know, we have auditing and we have auditing standards going on, and it's very difficult to dramatically change things. And then, of course, one of my students found in YouTube changing the tire of a car while they're moving.
Again, I would like to really thank Miklos for a really stimulating lecture.
It is now my pleasure to invite the President of the Victorian Division of CPA Australia, Mr. Mike Wilson, to the podium.
On behalf of CPA Australia and the University of Melbourne, I'd like to thank you all for being here tonight. CPA Australia is delighted to once again join with the University of Melbourne to present this annual research lecture, the oldest continuous research lecture series to be held anywhere in the world. It's now in its 71st year, so living proof that whatever they say about accountants, we're not going away anytime soon. Since its origins in 1940, this lecture has proven to be an invaluable platform for the latest thinking and research in accounting and finance to be shared and discussed. CPA Australia is particularly proud of this long-standing tradition and delighted with its ongoing partnership with the University of Melbourne. At the heart of this relationship is the belief that education empowers people and helps realise their potential, ultimately leading to advancement in the accounting profession. Tonight's lecture, for several years now officially part of CPA Congress Victoria, is another important contribution to stimulating debate in an emerging area and assisting professionals to grapple with new challenges. And there's a few of those in modern society, as we all know. This morning in Melbourne, I opened the proceedings for CPA Congress, the theme of which is navigating the new. Organisations around the world are looking to us to navigate through new operating models, regulations, and accounting methods. The academic world is uniquely placed to take a leading role in this quest through its commitment to gaining ever deeper insights into these challenging topics, sharing that expertise with the wider profession, and informing policy debates and regulatory direction. There seems to be a global trend towards different forms of assurance: compliance auditing, performance auditing, continuous auditing, covering a range of different topic areas such as greenhouse gas emissions and sustainable reporting. With this expansion in what we see as assurance, it is clear that many outside the accounting profession do not consider assurance to be the sole domain of accountants, unlike the accountants themselves. Therefore, in meeting the challenges associated with pressure from other professions, it is important for the accounting profession to be at the leading edge of new developments. As real-time reporting using tools such as XBRL grows worldwide, regulators and standard setters will need to consider the implications of such reporting on traditional assurance methods and the expectations of the report users. Professor Vassahaly is credited with the original continuous audit application and is the leading researcher in the field. His technical expertise and his important work in stimulating and shaping thought leadership in this emerging area has made for a compelling lecture. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of CPA Australia and the University of Melbourne, Professor Vassahaly, thank you for your presentation and insights this evening. So thanks once again.